This is Wednesday evening, October the 6th.
We'll be doing the class on Samuel. If you would go ahead and turn to 1 Samuel, chapter 1. And
sorry, I'm with the dispatcher here for you, if you don't mind. Me and Dad can't hear too good.
Sorry about that.
No, it's a...
Here now? Okay. That may be a bad sign. Just ask Joe. We'll be starting on Samuel. What we want to look at is going through an outline, so to speak. And the first thing we want to look at is considering the father. That's the first one we're introduced to. And we're told in chapter 1, at the very beginning, that the father is Elkanah. And what we know about Elkanah is that he was, which is going to play into line with Samuel being a priest in that line, is that Elkanah is of the Levitical line. He is of the Levitical ancestry for those to be able to serve as a priest. And if you would look at 1 Chronicles, the 6th chapter, we'll see the listing there of Elkanah. And the thing we need to realize is that there are several in that they pass down the name, just like Ray has over here. His granddad, his dad, him, his son. It's the same with Elkanah, is that there are several that are listed there in that name. When you look at starting in verse 25, the sons of Elkanah. Now, this is the older one. A couple years in ancestry there. It gives the sons of that Elkanah, and then he goes down, and then in verse 27, there's another Elkanah, his son. And that's the one who's Samuel's dad. And the sons of Samuel, in verse 28, were Joel the firstborn and Abijah the second. And when you look over at 33, the musicians that David set up in the service of the house of the Lord, part of those were the Kohathites that were the singer, the son of Joel, the son of Samuel, the son of Elkanah in verse 33 and 34, the son of Jeroham, the son of Eli, the son of Toa, the son of Zuk, the son of Elkanah, the son of Mahath, and the son of Messiah. The son of Elkanah, the son of Joel, the son of Azariah, and it goes through up until you get to where it's the son of Korah. So there you have the lineage, and also have mentioned there the sons of Samuel, which there's not a whole lot said about them except until later on when we look at Samuel's life, when it says that the sons of Samuel weren't doing what they were supposed to be doing. So they were priests also because they are of that line, that lineage, that line, and they weren't doing, and of course that's what prompted the children of Israel to ask for what? They asked for a king because Samuel grew old just like Eli, and his sons weren't doing what they were supposed to, and so they asked for a king. But 1 Chronicles gives you the lineage there, so that is why when we go into looking at Samuel, that's why he's able to be in the tabernacle. That's why he's able to be there, is because he is of that lineage. Okay. These were appointed, again, later on, they were appointed by David over the service of the song after the ark came to rest. But until then, they were there. The next thing we find about Elkanah is that he had two wives. Hannah is named first, and then Peninnah is listed second. And with Hannah being listed first, that would have been his first wife, and Peninnah would have been the second wife. And we find that he had children by Peninnah, but Hannah was barren. Now, I want to take a little bit of a side detour here, and we have this a lot in Scripture, of where there were those that had multiple wives. Now, bear in mind that in the very beginning, the Lord instituted marriage in the very beginning. And that institution is given in Genesis chapter 2, verse 24. And that institution was one man, one wife for life. And the words therefore, because the man and the wife, therefore for this cause, being what the Lord did in verses 22 and 23 of Genesis chapter 2, creating a man and woman, he said, now man should cleave or hold fast to his wife. When you look at the principle or the idea of to cleave and to hold fast, it's one of a faithful covenant. And that is what marriage is a faithful covenant. When you look at Deuteronomy, the 11th chapter, you have the same principle and concept with the word cleave or hold to. In the 11th chapter, in verse 22, for if you carefully keep all these commandments which I command you to do, to love the Lord your God, to walk in all his ways, and hold fast to him, then the Lord will drive out all these nations from before you, and he will dispossess greater than many nations than yourselves. To hold fast to him there. The New King James says to hold fast, but it's to cleave. So if you hold fast to him, to cleave to him. When you look in chapter 10 there of Deuteronomy, in verse 20, for you shall fear the Lord your God, you shall serve him, and to him you shall hold fast. Again, to hold fast, to cleave to be faithful to. When you look at the 13th chapter of Deuteronomy, in verse 4, again it's stated there, you shall walk after the Lord your God and fear him and keep his commandments and obey his voice. You shall serve him and hold fast to him. Again, that idea of cleaving and holding fast. When we look at where this started from, the taking of multiple wives is never encouraged in Scripture. God has never sanctioned it and said you do this. It was a result of man trying to accomplish something of his own means and ways. And there's several reasons for that, that it could be the possibility of why it was that way. But the Lord never sanctioned it. He tolerated it, but it did not mean that he approved of it. In fact, the rule set by the Lord when Israel was to enter the land given, and when the king was granted, that in Deuteronomy 17:17, he was not to multiply wives for himself. That is given strictly to the king. And again, in Deuteronomy 17:7, you have the foreknowledge of here of God in talking about neither shall he multiply wives for himself, lest his heart turn away, nor shall he greatly multiply silver or gold for himself. He's not to do that. And so there's God's, you don't do that. You don't have multiple wives. But when you look back, having children to the Jewish people and having descendants was of such great importance to them that a man and a wife often set about to achieve results circumventing the Lord's rule on marriage. If the wife was barren and couldn't have children, then they set about to change that. Because they looked at the lineage, much so more, I believe, is prevalent after Abraham. Because of the promise that was given to Abraham, and the descendancy that was starting from there, and how all the rest of the earth would be blessed through his seed and so forth, that the lineage became very important to them. You need the lineage, you need it there. Not only for the inheritance, so that the descendants would keep the same inheritance when they got in the promised land. But if you remember, that also that if a family, if the man died and he didn't have children, his brother was to take his wife, to take her as wife and have children, and if he, and so on and down the line. And that was to keep that lineage going. And they were very strong on that lineage, on that genealogy, so to speak. I'm not saying that gives an excuse. It doesn't. But it's a way that we can see in Scripture that they circumvented the Lord's requirement on marriage. The first that we find the multiple wives listed in the Scripture was in the fifth generation of Cain with Lamech. scripture in Genesis chapter 4 and verse 19, where Lamech, if you remember, told his wives that, wives, I've killed man. And so if Cain was avenged, I'm going to be avenged sevenfold. Well, there, it doesn't say why or how come, but he told his wives he had two. Then, of course, we're familiar with Sarai and Hagar. In Genesis, the 16th chapter, the Lord promised Abraham and Sarah that they would have children. Sarah said, well, Abraham, you and I are both old. We can't do it. Here's Hagar. Take my handmaid and have a child with her. And so Abraham did. And there again, you see, they were trying to circumvent, because Abraham said, well, my servant Eleazar, is he the one that's going to be the one that's going to inherit and everything? God said, no, you're going to have a son. Well, what about Ishmael? No, I'll do for Ishmael, but it's going to be your own son Isaac. So we're familiar with them going about circumventing the Lord's plan. God still brought about his plan, but again, you have Abraham having children through multiple women. Next, you have Jacob, or Israel. He served Laban for Leah. That should have been it. But he didn't. What did he do then? He served another 7 years for Rachel in Genesis chapter 29, verses 16 through 28. And of course, then they had their handmaids. And so there was a lot of descendants through all of them. You had David, that had concubines and multiple wives. You had Solomon that had wives and concubines. Now, with David and Saul's daughter, where Saul gave David his daughter to wife, you have to remember too, and this takes some consideration whether it applies or not, that when they were betrothed, then they were considered married, husband and wife. Okay, so even though David and Saul's daughter were betrothed and referred to as husband and wife, and it said then that Saul gave her to someone else, then it doesn't necessarily mean that they were actually married, but they were betrothed. Just the same as Joseph and Mary. They were betrothed, they weren't actually married. But in their society, the betrothal was the same as a marriage. On that, even though they had not come together. So, but we know Solomon had a lot of wives. Again, whether it's because of this promise that they wanted to keep their descendants going, so if they would always have a wife, someone there for the land, whatever, I don't know why. But here, Elkanah had multiple wives, and the first one wasn't able to have children. She was barren. So the second one we'll find when we look at the wives that she had children. Okay. So we find now next that Elkanah went yearly with his whole household to Shiloh. He went to Shiloh there to worship and sacrifice and to pay his vows, according to verse 3 and verse 21. He went to Shiloh. Now the reason that he went to Shiloh is because at the end of Judges, when we look at Joshua, the 18th chapter, and the 18th chapter of Judges, that the tabernacle and the Ark of the Covenant were at Shiloh. That's where it ended up at. This was before David moved it anywhere else. It was at Shiloh. So in Judges 18:31 and Joshua 18:1, that's where it was at, the tabernacle. So the Ark of the Covenant was there at Shiloh. The tabernacle was there at Shiloh. You went there each year to pay your vow, to do your sacrifices, to do all that at Shiloh. Because this is the place that the Lord named at that point in time. That's where it's going to be at. And that's where it was. And so that's why Elkanah went there with his sacrifices once a year. It doesn't say that he had any position in the tabernacle of being through the lineage. I don't know if he did earlier, if he didn't. That I don't know. He may have been out of the age range. It doesn't say. But he went every year, him and his family. He took his family. So you could say that, his family, I hate to use that term, were religious. To that point that they went with him to do the sacrifices and the vows. We find in verse 4 that he gave portions for the sacrifice to Hannah and all her sons and daughters. So they had sacrifices for themselves, for Peninnah, his wife, and for the sons and the daughters, all of his. So they were able, Elkanah gave them there, furnished them with that when they went up there. So they had that. We find in verse 5, though, that to Hannah, Elkanah gave a double portion because of his great love for her. He had love for her that he gave her a double portion to give as an offering and so forth on that. So that's some of the background of Elkanah, the father of Samuel, is that he went up every year. He made sure that his whole family had sacrifices, the requirements for them to be able to give sacrifices for their vows yearly to the Lord. And they made that trip. Of course, they lived where? They lived in Ramah. And this was going to be Samuel's hometown. When he went through his circuit, he always came back and stayed at Ramah because that's where his home was. And so they traveled from Ramah, which was a little bit to the west of, a little bit southwest, I believe, of Shiloh. Not far, but it was there. Ramah was. Okay. So then, any questions or any comments you want to make about Elkanah? Okay. We'll look at the wives next. Okay. Peninnah. She was very fruitful. In verse 4, she had sons and daughters. She was able to have children. She was very fruitful. But the thing about it was, would you consider her a religious person? Okay. We'll find out whether she was or not. Because she's referred to in verse 6 of chapter 1 as a rival. Now, it's hard enough, we saw the problems with Sarah and Hagar. Now here you have Hannah Peninnah. And Peninnah is a rival. She's referred to as a rival. And she didn't have a very good character. None whatsoever. She provoked Hannah bitterly. We find in verse 6. She provoked Hannah bitterly to irritate her because Hannah couldn't have children. She was mean and wicked, with no mercy or compassion. Verse 6. Her rival also provoked her severely. And that's bitterly. She provoked her severely to make her miserable. That was her intent, to make her miserable. Because the Lord had closed her womb. So it was year by year when she went up to the house of the Lord that she provoked her. Okay, this wasn't just a little bit at home. This was even when they went to worship. And you can probably imagine what it was. It's this continual provocation year after year was, I've got children. What did you give your husband? Children are, they were something that you were considered esteemed, the women were, back if they were able to have children, especially if they were able to have male children, because that would be going on with the inheritance and so forth. So I can imagine Peninnah, here we are, look at all the sacrifices I got for my parents. What have you got? You can't even have, And she just was just tormentous to her. And she provoked her, and this was continuing year after year. When you look at the word bitterly, it's mentioned in verse 6, bitterly or severely. And it's also mentioned again in verse 16. As far as the grief that she is told to Eli. And when you look at the word bitterly, severely, it means the conveyance of vexation, provocation, to trouble, to grieve, to be indignant, to the point of causing anger or wrath. just being plain spiteful. That was Peninnah. Just being plain spiteful. Why?
I think she's still supposed to, the husband loved Hannah.
That could be. But when we look at Hannah, we'll have to see, well, did Hannah use that as a tool? Did Hannah come back to Peninnah and say, well, you know, my husband loves me more than he does you. You may have kids, but he loves me more and he gives me double portion. But when we go to offer sacrifices and stuff, you know, is that the makeup of Hannah and her character? We can see the makeup of Peninnah here. But she's just a tumultuous woman, provoking Hannah all the time over this. And it was of no fault to Hannah. Hannah couldn't control this no more than anything. It wasn't her fault.
Everybody else tonight knows what was going on.
Oh, I'm sure if he lives in the house, he
would. He was why he was not her son's animal sacrifice to Shiloh.
I think he, by his statement a little bit later on, when he tries to console her, I think he was aware of it. Because we'll see a little bit later on, he says, Hannah, you know, I'm better than you than 10 sons. So I think you had to know it because he saw the distress. And we'll get into that with Hannah, the distress that she was under. Okay, but yeah, he was more than probably well aware of what was going on in his old house, his own household, the turmoil there. And, you know,
basically, he would have said something as soon as he found out about him and stuff, or that she needs to stop what she's doing. That's just...
I don't know. He didn't. He didn't try to control it, did he? He didn't try to control it.
Larry, if you look back at Jacob and Leah and Rachel, Leah did the same thing. She used her children to aggravate, provoke Rachel. And Rachel ended up having two by her handmaid. And when Leah stopped having children, she gave them her handmaid. So she was like, they were warring for who had the most kids.
Who had the most.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm saying. I think the land inheritance, the genealogy, the importance they placed on it, the seed coming through Abraham and everything. I think, you know, and plus the Levitical tribe, you know, as far as those could be. I think all that just all together, that there was a lot of importance placed upon having children. And poor old Hannah couldn't, you know.
Did they look at it like you were cursed by God if you couldn't have children, pretty much?
Somewhat, they felt that this was possibly from God on that. And, you know, we'll see with Hannah that she took it to God. But you have this wife here that is just constantly gnawing and bickering at Hannah. And put yourself in Hannah's place. Think about this. And the reason I say that is, have you ever had, and I call it anguish of heart, have you ever had the anguish of heart so strong and so bad that it disrupted you totally? It took away your peace. It took away your confidence. It took everything away from you. To have that anguish of heart when you think about it. And this is what Hannah ended up having that was being given to her year after year after year, day in and day in. This is what the one time a year when they went to Shiloh. This was all the time Peninnah was doing this. So I don't think she was doing it. She wasn't being correct in doing it. She may have went up there to do her sacrifices, but it really didn't do her any good because she had a bitter attitude, trying to provoke Hannah. She was just mean. Just mean, that's all you can say. She was mean. And, when it happened, we don't know. It just developed that way. Any other comment or question on Peninnah? Then we look at Hannah. Verses 2 and verse 5. She was barren because what? Because the Lord had closed her womb. They recognized that was from the Lord. Okay? Whether, you know, she wasn't able to have children. And so the scripture says, you know, that the Lord had closed her womb. We find in verse 6, she was made miserable. to the provoking by her rival, miserable to the point that the vexation was so great that it would cause Hannah to weep and had lost appetite, with her heart being so sad. Such anguish. Such vexation produced nothing but anguish of heart, according to verse 7, when you look at it. So year after year, when she went up to the house of the Lord, that she was provoked, that she provoked her, therefore she wept and did not eat. It just took everything away from her. The consolation from her husband of his great love for her that's given in verse 8 could not take away the grief that she was experiencing. He tried to help her in verse 8. Then Elkanah, her husband, said to her, "Hannah, why do you weep? Why do you not eat? And why is your heart grieved? Am I not better to you than 10 sons?" He's trying to smooth it over. And I'm sure he did love her, because it says in verses before, he loved her. Okay? And he's trying to console her, but it couldn't happen. She wasn't consoled. She was very spiritual, Hannah was, and dependent on the Lord, as we see her pouring out her heart to the Lord. Okay? She was greatly distressed over her lot in life and the vexation that her rival was continually giving her. Her bitterness of soul was so great and heavy upon her that she was weeping in anguish when you look at verse 10. Hannah rose after they finished eating and drinking in Shiloh, and in verse 10, and she was in bitterness of soul, prayed to the Lord, and wept in anguish. So, you know, this one occasion when she's going up here, it's really hit her hard after all those years. So, what would be the practical application for us? If you have such anguish in heart that you have a rival or any tribulation or trouble that's burdensome so bad to you that if you weep, if you can't eat, you just can't think, whatever, what's the solution to the problem?
Prayer.
The only way you can get comfort or peace on it is to take it to God. And that was how she obtained relief. That this time it's recorded in Scripture, she does prayer. She took and placed her affliction totally in the Lord's hands, showing great faith in the one who could deliver the solution to the problem. Now, let's look at the form of the prayer. What would you have done? Lord, that woman over there, would you take care of her? Lord, I've had enough of it. I get it year after year. Lord, it's not right. Do something with it. May, Lord, hide your face from her. Cause her trouble. Do anything. But just make her stop. It's not right, Lord. Make her stop. She's wicked. She's mean. Do something to her. That would be a selfish prayer. Now, would it be wrong? If a person is doing evil, is it wrong to ask the Lord to hide his face from them? That's not wrong. But vengeance or how the Lord handles it is up to him. Now, the Lord was well aware of what was going on. And how he takes care of it, that's up to him. He's well aware. Okay. So, the way Hannah takes care of it is she made a vow. She made a vow. The vow was the making of a voluntary promise to give or do something as an expression of consecration or devotion to the service of God. She made a vow to it. She just didn't say, "Lord, give me kids so I can touch this lady up. So I can hush this other wife up. Lord, just give me kids." You know. She made a vow. She was imploring the Lord to look upon the affliction she was suffering and to remember and not forget her as a maidservant of the Lord. In verse 11, she said, "Lord, look upon my affliction of your maidservant." I'm sure God knew it. What she's saying is to say, consider it. Look what I'm going through. You know what I'm going through, Lord. You know what it's doing to me. It's not that the Lord didn't see it. She's saying, hey, you know, look at it. He was well aware. But she is asking for his help. I'm going through this. I'm struggling with it. You know, I'm your maidservant. And remember me and not forget your maidservant on that. Now, a maidservant or a handmaid has a concept of one who is a female slave or a bondwoman, an unfree woman, one that is submissive, self-designation. And that's what she was saying. Totally different than Kanai. Here's Hannah. I'm totally in subjection to you, subservient to you. Please look upon me. And before we get into, you can look at it. We'll look at it next week. I want to explore some of the wording here in verse 11 and verse 19, where it says, "And remember me, and not forget." And then in verse 19, where it says, "And the Lord remembered her." We're out of time now. We'll look at that next week as far as what was she saying and what does that mean when you say, "Lord, remember me"? Does the Lord forget? Does the Lord not know? Remember me and don't forget. And the Lord remembered her. So, is it wrong to say that in a prayer?
Did David say that? Remember me? Who said that? Several times.
It might have been. I really don't know right now. I vaguely remember somebody saying that as far as remember the good that I've done. But I can't say right offhand right now whether it was David or not. Can we look that up for next week? Okay, we'll look that up for next week. Okay. And look at what's behind the
Nehemiah.
Nehemiah. Look that up next week as far as what it would be for remember.